It's time for Mac Geek Gab, and listener Dennis brings us our quick tip of the week. He says, my wife and I share a calendar where I can see when she is working. It happens quite often that I get 20 new notifications in the calendar inbox. I've learned that instead of accepting them one by one, I recently just held the OK button down on a notification, and then a little menu popped up and asked if that OK should apply to everything. Yes, please. That saved Dennis 19 different accept tabs. I love this tip, and I had no idea. More tips like this, plus your questions answered today on Mac Geek Gab 1061 for Monday, October 28th, International Animation Day 2024. And welcome to Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in tips just like that and we share them. You send in cool stuff found, we share them. You send in questions and we share those and hopefully can provide some answers or at least march us down the troubleshooting path each and every time we get together. Our sponsors for this episode include a return sponsor, Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com and their OWC Express 1M2 super fast portable drive. Over 3,000 megabytes a second. Anyway, we'll talk about those details. I know. We'll talk about those details in a little bit. For now, here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in South Dakota, I'm Adam Christensen.
And we are missing Pete today. He is off flying the airplane. Yep. But I guess our police code for today, for 1060, the 1061 police code, at least on the list that I looked up, says it's either personnel in vicinity or not wanted. Well, Pete, you are certainly not wanted. So this is personnel not in the vicinity. Maybe if we combine the two of those.
I was so hoping it was missing person.
I know. Yeah, that would be good. We will fly in the missing man formation nonetheless. Our giveaway for this month is Eternal Storms. If you go to MacGeekGab.com/giveaway, Eternal Storms is giving away 5 copies of Yoink and Screen Float here in October. So you've got a few more days to get in on that before it tips over to November and we have a new giveaway coming. You can always look once it's the first of the month. Usually this is still a manual thing that we have to kind of place into position on the first of the month, but maybe we'll automate that too. It seems like something that could be automatable, does it not?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's WordPress. It should be able to. Anyway, we'll figure that out at some point. But for November, I'm pretty sure it's still going to be something manual. But once we get that in place, you'll see. And then, of course, we'll talk about that on next week's show, too. So, yeah, that's what I got. Anything else before we get into the rest of the quick tips here, Adam?
No. I say we dive into things. I don't have a lot going on.
Diving.
Right now, so I'd like to learn some things.
Yeah, there we go. Listener Doug, in the calendar realm, continues. He says, I spend most of every day driving between appointments with clients. I've long bemoaned the lack of to-do type apps for CarPlay so that I can remember who to call or message while I'm driving. Don't worry, he says. I never touch or look at my phone while driving. He says, I really don't even look at CarPlay unless I'm stationary. Anyway, I've solved the to-do list problem by adding a stack of appointments to my calendar of around 15 minutes in length to the end of my day. These remain visible in the calendar app on CarPlay throughout the day, and those that don't get dealt with simply get moved to the next day. And, as a bonus, if I add a phone number in the location field, then I can simply tap the screen in CarPlay to make an outgoing call for that event. I was prompted to send this because of the comment about reminders in calendars. Quite a nice feature since I can mark things as done from the CarPlay screen, but unfortunately, it doesn't give me the ability to tap a phone number that I've added as a reminder. Oh, what a miss for Apple, adding all of that and then not having the phone number be a data detectors kind of thing. So, yeah.
S-Lady can do quite a few number of things with to-do lists, right?
Like, correct.
You can add and check off and ask her to let you know what's on your to-do lists and stuff like that, right? I haven't played with that too much, but I think there's a lot of to-do list functionality or commands.
That's a good question.
I don't use lists. I know you can like specifically add things to specific lists with the right.
Yes.
Because I've done that with a grocery list, and that's great in the car. You know, you're like, oh, yeah, I need to go do that.
Yep. Oh, I do that all the time. I just tell the S lady, you know, remind me. I find because I don't use undated to-dos in my workflow, and I won't see them in my workflow, I have to remember to say, hey, S lady, remind me today or remind me tomorrow. And then it will put a dated to-do in. And then it's fine. I even have, because of this sort of hole in my workflow, I have a once weekly recurring to do that reminds me to go into reminders and check for undated ones that accidentally got added that way. But yeah, that's a handy thing for sure. But yeah,
but this calendar trick for CarPlay, I don't even think I knew there was a calendar app in CarPlay. But
yes,
I mean, I mostly only use it for music and maps, to be honest.
Yep. Yeah, I am. There is a calendar app. There has been for a little while, and it's handy to be able to go and like see events in calendar. The data detectors in it are mostly good, but occasionally, like, it'll show me the address of an event and not let me tap it to go to the map. Most of the time I can tap and it goes to the map, but sometimes it's just like, yeah, look at these fancy words and numbers you have here. Cool. Thanks.
Yeah. So Jim has been trying to sort things in the Finder. He says this. He says, perhaps, probably, it's a sign of old age, but recently I found myself stuck trying to rearrange the sort order from ascending to descending file name in a column of files in Finder. I was in column view, which is my standard, and just couldn't get it done. A quick Google Foo search led me to an answer I probably knew but forgot. You can only change the sort order from ascending to descending or vice versa if you are in the list view. Simply click on the column that you want to change the sort order in. For me, it was date added. I also was reminded that the way to add a column in list view is to right-click on the column header name and click the column you want to add. So it sounds like, and then he provided a couple of links, which we'll provide in the show notes. He says, familiar skills I had forgotten, so perhaps helpful to others.
Yeah. We confirmed with Jim that once you change the sort order in list view, when you go back to column view, that persists, which is,
that was going to be my immediate question, which wasn't part of this tip. So I'm glad you added that.
Yep. Yeah. I was like, well, this is great if you're in list view, but like, does it stay? And he's like, of course. Yeah, it sticks. He's like, that's why I sent the tip in. I'm like, I thought so. Just wanted to.
That's so weird that they wouldn't just let you do it in column view, but I guess maybe it'd be confusion over which column. I mean, but you could right click in the column and it would just affect that column, I would think, you know.
Yeah,
that's how I would do it. I don't know.
Yeah, I find column view very limiting for me. I live in list view. What's that? Is it really?
Oh, really? Yeah, because I'm constantly moving things left to right. And I don't like having to jump up and down the tree.
Yeah.
I feel like I can move quicker up and down the tree in column view than list view.
All right. So I have another tip for column view while we're here. When you're in column view, where I spend very little of my time, there's the little handle at the bottom right corner of the current, you know, rightmost column that you see, or actually of any column, I suppose. Yeah. Of any column that's got content in it. And you can drag the little handle there. It looks like a pause button, really. But you can drag the little handle to change the width of that particular column. You can also hold down Option key when you're dragging that handle, and all columns will adjust their width at the same time. So
that's to the same size, right?
To the same size. Yes. Sorry. Thank you for the clarification. Yep.
There's another one where if you just double click on the line, it will expand to the size of the longest thing in that column.
Oh, that is life changing. Oh, yeah. This might make me hate column view less. Yeah, because it seemed like I always use the analogy. It feels like I'm typing with mittens on. Like when I go to column view, it's like I want to see the file names. And I also want to sort
the full
by
file name, yeah.
Yeah, I want to sort by, you know, date added or whatever. Can I? There's no other. Oh, you can. So let's see.
You can right click in the column and change that.
And change the sort view?
Yeah.
I just right clicked in it.
It looks like it changes all columns, but yes.
Where are you clicking to do
that? In Finder? Just in Finder. I'm just clicking in the middle of the empty area of the column and I have a sort by.
I do not. This is weird. Oh, I have to click. You're right, in an empty area. But if you've got a
like
full
below.
If you've got a full column, finding that little empty area requires a little bit more finesse. But you're right. You also can do it by going to the view menu and choosing sort by date modified, and then boom, there it goes. But you're right, that changes everything.
All columns. I wonder if the tip we just did only does the column that you're in. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good
question. Be interesting to know.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, hard to say. Only because the column I was in was not a good one to test that with.
You can also, if you want to be totally visual, you can add the sort by little icon. If it's, I don't know if it's up there by default to, you know, the customized toolbar at the top.
Oh, it's up there for me. I don't know if that was by default or some action I took over the years.
I mean, a handy one that isn't a default one while we're on this subject that some people like is the path. So there's a little path toolbar icon. So you can put that up there. And then when you click on it, it's a little drop down and it shows you the full path to where you are.
Wait. Oh, I thought you were going to talk about the view show path bar, which shows the path of the file at the bottom
of the bottom. Yeah, I use that, but there's actually in the toolbar, because we were kind of talking about the toolbar.
I like this.
So, you know, right at the top, you can right click and you can say customize toolbar, and then it gives you little icons that you can drag up there.
Yeah.
And one of those is the path bar.
What? And if I hit that, it just...
icon.
And then you can navigate through the path. It's interactive.
Yes.
Like I can go up the chain.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of more for visual mousey kind of people, I think, but...
Yeah, that's true, because I would normally be doing this with the keyboard. You're right. But still... Oh, I want to have that there. Oh, man.
Whoa, okay, what did I just do now?
I don't know. I don't know the answer.
Okay. I mean, this is a new OS thing, but... I was holding down the option key when I drug my window... And it's doing the new macOS window thing. No, where it locks into like half the screen or whatever.
Oh, yep. One must be aware and careful of that.
Yeah, I did it accidentally. It's like, cool. All right. What I was trying to do is figure out if I could drag, I could hold Command key and drag that icon out of my my toolbar, and I could.
So. In our live chat here in Discord, Porthos John says group by is also useful. And that is another widget that you can add to the toolbar there so that you can group by file type and get the sort within groups or group by, you know, you can group by date. You can group by, what are the other things? Kind. Yeah, those sorts of things. I like that. Great.
Yep.
And then he says
that one drives me a little bit nuts, but yeah,
same. It breaks it out too far for me. It's hard to look at, but I can see if you're looking for show me all the PDFs that are here, that might be a helpful thing to see. And then Porthos John says one that he learned from MGG years ago and have used ever since is command click on the file name and you get the path upward too. This must only be in column view. Is that no? Command click on the file name. I'm not getting that. I'm missing what the instruction is on that, because when I try it here. Oh, the folder name at the top of the window. Yes. Right. If you float over the name of the folder in any view in the Finder at the top of the window and click it, it will show you that same path, basically the same thing that's in the path dropdown. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Very nice. Thank you.
Lots of stuff.
Lots of good stuff.
Extra bonus tips.
Extra. We love extra bonus tips. It's kind of how things go. All right, folks. Listen, you know that I've been using OWC's gear for years, and I'll say it again. These folks get it, and I am super stoked to have them back as a sponsor. Super stoked. Their OWC Express 1M2 is like strapping a rocket engine to your Mac. This thing is fast. Listen, we're talking up to 3,151 megabytes per second of real-world performance, fast enough to make your data feel like it's running for the Olympic gold medal. This thing's built for the future with USB 4, Thunderbolt, and USB-C compatibility, and wrapped in aircraft-grade aluminum. So good that even Pete loves it. So yeah, it's basically the superhero of portable drives. Plus, it's so durable, you could probably drop it from a helicopter. Though, maybe don't try that. Pete doesn't really like flying in helicopters anyway. But hey, if you do, your data is still safe. Portable, bus-powered, I know. And it even comes with a screwdriver for your do-it-yourself assembly if you want to put your own drive in there. Yeah, it's cool. So look, don't get caught slowing down your Mac with anything less. Check out the OWC Express 1M2 now at MacSales.com. And while you're there, check out the other stuff that they have, because everything I've used from them, and you know how much stuff in my setup I use from them, works great. And, you know, their commitment to customer service and product quality is unparalleled. So go check them out, MacSales.com, MacSales.com. And our thanks to OWC for sponsoring this episode. And while I've got you here, if you're into tech news, security, entertainment, and, well, a bit of grumpy ranting, then you need to check out the Grumpy Old Geeks podcast. Now, I know what you're thinking. Oh, great. Two old white guys talking tech. But wait, sometimes there are three of them over there. This sounds familiar. Brian and Jason have been podcasting for over a decade with more than 650 episodes under their belt, with a combined 50 years of experience in the internet trenches. These guys have seen it all. They've watched the dream of a Star Trek-style future turn into a William Gibson dystopian nightmare of legless virtual avatars and a cloud of vaporware nonsense. Flying cars? Nope. Still waiting for those. But hey, at least we have corporate surveillance and NFTs, right? With many swears and plenty of feels, Brian, Jason, and the occasional guest deep dive into what went wrong on the internet and who's to blame. Don't get caught missing out on this grumpy goodness. Tune in every Saturday for the real deal on our tech-filled future. Go to GOG.show or search for Grumpy Old Geeks on your favorite podcast platform. Listen, they'll make you feel better about the fact that self-driving cars are still 20 years away. Or not. Go check them out. GOG.show. And thanks for doing this swap with us, guys. Shall we go into some follow-ups? We had a lot of reaction to last week's show. And only a small amount of it was the creepy jackalope image. Which reminds me of a Super Sucker song, which was Creepy Jackalope Eye. But anyway, shall we do some follow-ups? Yeah.
Absolutely. And this one is kind of relevant. I have something to add to it.
All right.
So here we go. This is from Steve. He says, just listened to episode 1060, and I heard the question about connecting a new iPhone 16 to an older Mac. I'm in the same situation. I just got an iPhone 16 and I have a 2017 MacBook Pro with Ventura. Mm. Yes, I'm overdue for an updated Mac. Anyway, you're not. I have a 2019 and I think we're fine.
Yeah,
anyway, I digress. And he says, anyway, I wanted to connect my phone to transfer some music, and the included USB-C to USB-C cable did not work. That is correct, and we'll probably explain a little bit why. A few minutes of searching led me to a solution. I used a USB-C to USB-A cable with an adapter to USB-C. Not sure if it matters which side goes into which port, but I put the adapter side on my Mac. It worked. Totally ridiculous. I totally agree. He says also, by the way, I too am a DHCP reservation spreadsheet enthusiast. Woo-hoo! Nerd. His words, not mine.
These are words of endearment, Adam.
I always thought I was the only one. Keep up the great work. Steve.
So this is interesting to me because we're doing USB-C on one side, right? And it's USB-C on the other. So it's what's happening in the middle that matters. Yep. And I don't think it has, I don't think it is dependent on going C to A to C in the middle.
No.
Right? Like that's, okay.
No, it's your cable. That's the problem. And the fact that Apple only includes a charging USB-C cable in the box is criminal.
I think that's the problem. I think that's it, is that this cable's not capable of data transfer, but yet the one that he went from C to A to C is capable of data transfer.
Yeah. Yeah, it was probably an old iPhone cable, you know, when we were back in the USB-A to you know, whatever days.
Yeah. 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 So I think that's
probably not an iPhone cable, but you know, it was a cable that does that. So here's where my tie-in comes into place. You know how you avoid this? You get your USB-C cables from OWC because they have high quality ones that do the full bandwidth and everything. They'll cost you more, but yeah, I use only OWC USB-C cables for this reason. Otherwise, you have to do a little bit of your research. I mean, I do. I have bought cables from, I'm going to blank on the name of that cheap cable place that I always used to use. It'll come to me, but you know, you can buy cheaper cables, but you have to pay attention to what you're getting because there are literally ones that just do charging.
Right.
And don't have the data transfer. There are also ones that go at different data transfer speeds. So if you want, you know, full Thunderbolt 4, you know, transfer speeds, you have to get the right USB-C to USB-C cable. So this is another thing to be aware of when you're like looking for that stuff. So, and it's super confusing and it all comes down to the USB spec and how the cable is made and what pins are turned on or not on. And it sucks.
I did a deep dive. We've probably talked about this, Adam. I dissected it on the show here, but after that, there was a video years ago, a couple of years ago, not that long ago, where the How It Works guys, I think, dug into like Apple's $140 Thunderbolt cable with a CAT scan machine or something. And instead of comparing it to, say, OWC's Thunderbolt cable that has the same specs to see, like, is there a difference? They compared it to a $9 cable on Amazon that was like charging only or something. So it was not an apples to apples comparison. And I mean that in both ways, right? And so that like gave me the idea. It was like, okay, but I don't have a CAT scan machine, but I do have a lot of gear here, and I can test functionally whether the inexpensive cables at Amazon work the same as the expensive cables from, like, you know, certified cables is what I should say, from Apple or OWC or Cable Matters or any of those. And so I did. And I found that this was catalyzed by the fact that I went on a trip once and grabbed some USB-C cables and found that while I had the cables that I had with me, all would pass data and of course all would charge, none of them would work with my external screen. And it was like, well, this is a bummer. I want to be able to use my external screen. So that's when I dug in and I found a couple of interesting things. USB 4 cables work as Thunderbolt cables. There is no functional difference. Now, is there a technological difference? Possibly. Is there a tolerance difference? Most likely. But also, there's a certification difference. And on a Thunderbolt 4 cable, you've got to pay the Thunderbolt 4 consortium, you know, Gestapo, whatever it is, to certify your cable, and it costs you money. And so if you're not paying for that, then you wind up with the same functionality, at least as far as I can tell. Again, mine was all real world testing. There was no like, I'm going to test the electrical resistance on this pin. No. I just plugged them in. Does it work? And did it work for a day? That was my test. And it was like, yeah. So you can buy cables that are certified as USB 4. And even cables that are not certified but called USB 4 all seem to work for me. Now, I will add a huge asterisk to that. In my like workflow here in the studio, for example, I don't have any of those non-certified cables because I don't want to have to ask that question when I have some weird audio issue. Like, oh, is it related to that crummy cable where I saved $24 instead of buying the OWC one? Like, I have like either all OWC or all fully certified cables here. Well, the OWC ones are also certified. So I have all fully certified cables in my workflow simply to rule out future troubleshooting questions. But I digress. I think that's what we do here. The digression. It's part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so confusing. Like, I mean, even USB 4 cable, I just like did some Googling and speeds can range from 40 gigabits per second to 80 gigabits per second, depending upon if you have USB 4 1.0 or USB 4 version 2.0.
That's true. That's true.
It's just like,
yep.
The label, that would spend my only complaint with USB across the board. I mean, this has been since USB 3, USB 2. There were all these different flavors, all these different versions, all these different specs. And you had to know what you were getting. Whereas, I mean, the nice thing about Thunderbolt was Thunderbolt. If version one was Thunderbolt version one, and it worked all the same if it was Thunderbolt version one, version two, version, you know, whatever. So,
yep.
I digress.
Yep. You know. It is.
Oh, and sorry, the place where you can get, I don't want to call them cheap, you can get inexpensive, pretty good quality cables that I've had good luck with is Mono Price is the name of the company.
Oh, yes.
And I ordered cables from them for years, and they have all kinds of cables and pretty good deals. So my other supplier for cables is, of course, Anker.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah.
We've talked about them in the past, too.
Yep. Yeah. I really like Mono Price's cables. I use some of them on my computers, but they are the place that I buy audio cables from to use both in the studio here. In fact, well, this one's a right angle cable, and Monoprice, the last time I bought, did not sell right angle cables. So I probably don't have a right angle cable on this microphone. But otherwise, every other cable that I have in here is Monoprice. And every cable that I bring with me to gigs that isn't a right angle cable, because I also like right angle cables when I'm playing my drums so that I'm not hitting the cable with a stick. All of them are Monoprice, and they are super heavy duty and reliable and all of the things, and way inexpensive. Like, they're really good stuff. Yeah.
Compared to other places. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, compared to other places with equal quality, right? Like,
correct.
Cause I need to, the stuff in the studio, I could go with cheap cables here cause things aren't moving around. At gigs, man, like, I am not kind to those things. You got to set them up fast. And then at the end of the night, it's 1 a.m. It's like, I want to, like, GTFO. Like, let's roll them and go. Like, and you know, yank them and roll them and put them in a bag and forget about them until the next gig. So, yeah.
Yeah, I just replaced my, so, you know, the Apple Vision Pro comes with, I think, a 6-foot cable for the charging. And I'm like, I want something where I can actually like move away from the wall charger a little bit. So I ended up getting one of those. I mean, we don't have access to much services in this town, and I needed it fast. And so, you know, I went to Walmart and I got whatever that their Walmart brand is. I forget what it's called. Someone in the chat will probably put it in there. But I bought that thing. That thing lasted it wasn't even abused. Like, it sat in the same place for not very long. It lasts like 3 months, and it's like, trying to plug it in and use it for my iPhone to charge, and it's like going out. And my wife's like, why is this thing's not charging? And it's like, yeah, that's crappy cable. I replaced it with an Anker one. It's been great.
That's good. So. Yeah, the Anker cables are good. I'm not going to put a link to the Walmart cables. Are you talking about RVP? Is that their house brand?
No, they have a house brand. It's called
Yeah, I don't know.
Go, or I can't remember.
I'm looking.
It's their electronics brand. It's sort of like what... Because
they also sell Anker, at least online or whatever. But yeah, okay.
Yeah. All right. That's because they have the Amazon model online, right?
Of course.
Anybody can sell through them.
Yes, right. FBW, fulfilled by Walmart. Yep. Yeah.
It's, I'll figure out what it is, and I'll fill people in before the end of the show.
Hey, a heads up. And we're recording this on Friday the 25th. It comes out on the 28th, of course. But Porthos John points out that the iOS 18.2 beta, so you've got to be on the developer beta, allows chat GPT integration and allows you to log in to your paid account if you have one. I am stoked about this. Lisa and I went down to Boston last night, and on the way back, you know, as often happens in the car, we were, you know, musing on different things. And I wonder about that. And how about this? And so I keep triggering ChatGPT, and I use the voice mode. And I have the voice mode of ChatGPT tied to my action button on my iPhone 16 so that I can easily get there while I'm in the car. But it still requires the phone to get itself unlocked. And then, you know, you got to hold the action button, and it's not the best experience. And even last night, Lisa was like, I can't wait until Apple just integrates this with the S Lady. And it's like, oh, it seems like today is a day. So, we'll see if I've requested it on mine, but we'll see if it comes in. Hopefully soon.
I hope so. Fun. On with two N's is the Walmart electronics brand. O-N-N.
That's good to
it's
know.
Cheap.
Okay.
Stuff.
All right.
But I mean, if you want a cheap, you know, TV, they have them. I don't know who actually manufactures their stuff, but
there's a phrase that
I didn't expect it to be good.
There's a phrase that I love that I can't take credit for, and nor do I want to. But it was used frequently by Neil Peart, the late drummer of the band Rush, in all of his prose books. He liked to stay at crummy motels. In between stops on the road, he would ride his motorcycle around, and he loved crummy motels. And so he would often write in his travel journal, if the hotel was especially crummy, cheap and worth it.
Yep.
So it is a phrase that has stuck with me. All right. Seth has the next follow-up from episode 1060. He says, Todd was talking about shutting off a display while in a focus mode with a shortcut. He says, Seth says, you can do this directly in the focus mode settings under focus filters. There is a filter that will shut off the display while in that focus mode. So I like this. This is good. I will. So there you go. Yeah. Hopefully that helps, Todd. Yeah. I don't know. I did not. I was not aware of that. But yep, there it is. And there it is.
Very, very cool.
Yep.
James. All right. James. Yeah. James has a little bit of follow-up. He says, I am enjoying your show over an evening coffee. Wow. And listening to issues with Apple Notes and its database. More specifically, someone wanting to extract pieces. Some years back, I came upon Notebooks by Aflons Schmid. Hopefully I said that name right. And I've stuck with it. The key feature for me is that it does not create a proprietary database to deal with. Rather, it uses a folder on your drive as its container. Within that are books, folders, and pages, documents. It accepts all kinds of documents, such as PDFs, HTML, images, text files. I can create sketches, text files, format docs, and markdown docs, as well as photos, videos, and videos with camera access. Internally, externally, external hyperlinks work. Docs dropped into the folders automatically show up in the notebook. A bit of a kludge are multiple notebooks, which are accomplished by pointing it at a different hard drive folder. Multiple copies of notebooks sync up by pointing them to the same shared folder. He offers iPhone, iPad, Mac, and Windows versions. Very cool. Recently, with improvements to Apple's Notes, I have brought them closer, but I generally use my notes as throwaway scraps of notes, while Notebooks is my permanent book that I carry and use everywhere. Huh. Sounds like a pretty cool app.
It sure does. I love the idea of flat file storage as opposed to SQLite database storage.
I mean, this is why I use Markdown for everything, and I use Ulysses for notes. Like, I don't use the Notes app for this exact reason, and Ulysses syncs, and everything is just, you know, files and folders ultimately, but, you know, I can easily get things in and out, and I'm also not tied. I use Markdown because I'm not tied to proprietary formats, and I know at the end of the day, it's always just a text file,
right?
So you don't fall prey to the issue of, you know, I have it in some proprietary format that, and then that app dies and now I can't get it out of whatever proprietary document format it's in.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I need to rethink my world here. Cause I went all in on Apple Notes. I used Yojimbo was probably the first note taking app that I used, and from Barebones. And then I moved to Evernote. I was there for a while and then moved to Apple Notes primarily because of how we do things for this show. And Apple sure. Notes has some level of scriptability, which is what went away with the Evernote updates in recent years. So I can use shortcuts or Apple Script to control things in Notes. And that's proven very helpful for us for show prep. However, the storage of things is not the best. So, I'm curious. This Notebooks app, I looked, it does sync because you can just store it in like your Dropbox or even Apple's iCloud Drive because it's flat folders. And so anything that can read yep. those folders, which includes your iPhone and your iPad, can, and they have iPhone and iPad apps as well as a Mac app for this. So they just all work. They do say that you can import from Evernote, Apple Notes, Circus Pony's Notebook, or your good old Palm Pilot, which is also interesting. So I'm curious. I need to think about this. So I wonder if there is any script ability. I know that this Notebooks app does support Markdown, so that's good. Shortcuts. Is there automation? That's the thing I'm looking for. I'm not finding it on their feature page, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means they didn't surface it on their feature page here. So, all right.
Well, I mean, if they're just text files, I mean, you should have some native scriptability, right?
Right, like, but
you
like
can go into a folder and read text out of a text file or something like that. But
like right now, I am about to take this note from our MGG current show folder and archive it in the MGG archive folder. And I have a keystroke that makes that magic happen. I don't need to drag with my mouse and answer the questions. I just hit the sure. magic button and it's done. And that's done, I believe, with Apple Script. I can't remember if it's Apple Script or shortcuts. It's triggered with gotcha. Keyboard Maestro for the keyboard part of it, but it's either one or the other, right? And that scriptability for this purpose is great. But like, there's a world where we could use Notes just for this show, and then I could move to something a little more portable for the rest of my life, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'll tell you the other thing about, I mean, the other thing that's really handy for me with everything being in Markdown is just the ability to then use a tool. I mean, there's stuff built into Ulysses. I use Brett Terpstra's Marked,
okay,
which is part of SetApp, by the way, which allows you to kind of have a live preview of a formatted version, and you can look at it in different styles and stuff like that. And not only that, it does all the conversions. So I can take my marked file, and then if I do want to send it to somebody as a Word doc, I just convert it to a Word doc or a PDF or a rich text file. You know, and it's the same source content, but I can put it in whatever format I want and send it off to somebody if they don't want to deal with Markdown. And I do this at work all the time. I start all my documents in Markdown and then typically share them at the office, obviously in, well, maybe not obviously, but share them in a Word format because that's most people at the office are used to working with, right?
Huh.
Yeah, that's great.
This is great. Yeah. So I will alert all of the aforementioned developers to this discussion. I'm curious if Notebooks or Ulysses supports some kind of automation, either, you know, AppleScript or shortcuts or both.
I'm pretty sure Ulysses does. They
yeah.
might even have that, some shortcuts from what I remember.
Would have like been my guess. Yeah. So this is interesting. And of course, Notes... current ability to be able to sync a specific notebook amongst multiple people like we do here is also a good thing. So I'm not eager. Our workflow seems to work for now, but as we've been having these discussions about Notes, I've been getting less and less comfortable with this data that I rely on being, I know it's a SQLite database. And at the end of the day, I could like find or write a way to get stuff out of it, or have ChatGPT assist me in writing the commands to turn this into RTFD files. But and maybe I should do that and like give it to the world if I can make it work, because that would be a nice thing to be able to get your notes out as RTFD files. But still, I don't know. I don't like being trapped in inside Notes. There's no good way to export. So,
Yeah.
All right. Scott helps us with that, though. Uh-oh. Well, that was weird. My sound cut out for a second. Maybe I do have a crappy USB cable in here somewhere. Scott says, in episode 1060, there was a lively discussion about backing up notes. It took me a while to figure out how to do this, but it is actually quite simple. I use an app called SyncTime to selectively back up specific folders. Okay. I do this with my notes data, my calendar data, and my contacts, although I also run an AppleScript via Keyboard Maestro every week that exports all of the contacts, as separate V cards. Very handy. That is very handy. He says, I have the destination on a separate backup drive, which for notes backs up the source folder. It's in your, you know, user folder, user library, group containers, group.com.apple.notes. And I will put that in the show notes so that we all kind of have it there. However, I will point out that what this folder has is simply all of the files in theory required for the SQLite database. And you could, in theory, just pop this into the same folder on a new Mac and then launch Notes and it would pull it back in. I asked Scott if he has tried this restore operation, and he hasn't yet. I agree with him that it seems like this would work, but where my head kind of flashes a light is, but Notes also syncs with iCloud Drive. So I know that there's a cache of that somewhere else. And then there's the whole syncing engine that happens that we aren't touching. And I think Apple years ago had a knowledge base article that says, as if a swarm of bees avoid this, you know, this whole sync folder. So, and I believe them because they don't say things like that terribly often.
Right.
they are not prone to hyperbole. So I don't like, I grok that this would, in the end, you could make this work. I guarantee it, right? It's a SQLite database. It has your notes in it. You might have to go through some steps like turn off AppleScript syncing of notes, restart your computer, quit notes, put this in there, you know, let it sit for an hour, make some changes so that the data like is updated, then try turning on syncing again, see what happens, blah, blah, blah. It's better than not having this folder backed up. Like your data is there. I believe
right.
that.
Yeah.
I just don't know how difficult or easy the restoration process might be. And I think it would be different for a lot of different circumstances. But thank you, Scott. Yes.
Agreed. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Don't get caught.
Don't get caught.
Well, yeah. Okay. What do we have here? We had more reviews come in. I know Pete likes to read those, but I love all the reviews. So I'm gonna take a minute, and as soon as I can find them, I'm gonna read them, because we had, oh no, that's not the reviews. Wait, see, Pete had this problem last time with the reviews, and he found the wrong ones, and I was about to do the same thing. All right, Here, we got three reviews. The first from Virtual Stash in the United States. All three are from the United States. One of the best. I have three favorite podcasts regarding Apple technology. This is the one I would give up last. Consistently good. The good cheer of the remaining original host, I think that's me, never wanes and uplifts every Monday morning. Thanks, Virtual Stash.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. MKMCEMD from the United States says, Matt Geekab, love the show since 2012. We love you since 2012. That's amazing. Awesome. And KC Watt from the United States says, always on point. This podcast has been a staple in my listening luxury for over a decade. Always useful information and always a weekly listen. Keep up the excellent work. Well, these are excellent reviews and they do warm our hearts. We are happy about them, but also they do kind of help with a variety of things, social proof and, you know, all of the stuff that sort of, I know Apple says it doesn't help the algorithm. I don't know. Every time we've had a wave of reviews,
I don't buy it.
Yeah. I could be wrong.
Maybe not in their algorithm directly, but I think when people are looking for things to listen to, obviously this matters. And I know that subscriptions and people listening, and especially new listeners, are part of that algorithm. I know one of the tricks was to, like, if you want your podcast to go up, you can take a 2-month break and then everybody will unsubscribe. And then when you come back, they subscribe again and you go.
You're right that when people click subscribe in Apple Podcasts, that does it direct. That is perhaps the biggest signal to the algorithm that that people can do. And so I'm certainly not suggesting this, but I've heard podcasters tell people, please go back in and resubscribe. Just go click the subscribe button again, even if you're already subscribed, and that works. So I'm certainly not advising you to do that, but I'm just telling you what I've heard.
We would never say
something like that. That'd be preposterous, Adam. All right, shall we actually add some value here and answer some questions?
We got some questions. Yeah. Sarah has a question for you. Actually, I got a series of questions for you, Dave.
Oh, boy.
So starting with Sarah, she says, hi, I'm saving photos sent to a Gmail address to Drive and renaming them. So far, this is a 2-step process of saving to Drive and then finding renaming. Do you know of an extension or a hack to do this in one step? A little more information. This is for an elementary school yearbook. The parents would put categorical data in the subject line, and we would have a Google extension that would the photo attachments to the drive with the new file name. Any help? Moving forward, we'd like to be changing the system for collecting photos. So just looking for an easy hack to add on or to make this year go faster. Love the show and any all photo related tips. Thank y'all.
Okay. So work with me on this here, Adam. I don't have like a, no. I wish I had a, you know, go download this thing and you're good to go. If that exists, feedback@mattgeekab.com. Tell us, we'll tell Sarah. So there's that.
Okay.
I would generally use Hazel or a better Finder rename, probably Hazel, because of its ability to automate things based on when an item is added to a folder, right? That Hazel delivers on the promise that Apple gave us with folder actions. And then you can trigger all kinds of things. It has some stuff built into it, renaming being one of them, moving, you know, all that stuff. But you can also trigger an Apple script and do all kinds of things. So that's where my brain goes, but that's not going to be able to do what you want because it's not going to know anything about the subject line of the email. I don't think when you save an image from, Gmail, that it adds the metadata of, say, the subject line somewhere to the image. If it is, then maybe we can use AppleScript to extract that and all that. So I started thinking about what we do here, Adam, because we use the clipboard as part of that. Like our automation for this question, in fact, when before we fire off the reply email, we hit, select all and copy to the clipboard. and then trigger the automation to create the note that Adam and I are reading from right now. And it's all based on what I put on the clipboard initially, and then, you know, off the automation goes. And at some point in the process, it grabs the active clipboard, and hopefully it hasn't changed in the middle, which, of course, it could, but it probably wouldn't have because it's all happening pretty quickly. So my thought is copy the subject line to the clipboard and then save the file, and then have the automation from Hazel rename the file using, in part, the contents of the clipboard, which in theory is the subject line of the email because you've already copied that there.
Yeah.
I don't know if we can make it better than that, but that's step one, you know, beta version one of this solution.
Yeah. I need to get in and probably do a lot more experimentation with shortcuts.
We all do. So
I feel like there is not. I was wondering if there was already something in shortcuts for like getting specific contents of an email, and I'm not seeing anything when I just did a quick search, but man, that would be handy, right?
Yeah.
And you would think it wouldn't be that difficult, right? Like, you activate a shortcut, you're on a mail message, in at least in mail, you know, even if it was relegated to just Apple's built-in mail.
Yeah, you should be able to
grab the email address, Apple grab the script, body of the email.
Apple Script can grab the subject and the attachment, in theory, for sure. Because I've our current workflow, I tried using Apple Script and Apple Mail and making all of that kind of work.
Yeah.
And it where it has trouble is in creating new messages and then knowing about and then doing things to that new message, because mail doesn't really give you a file handle for that. But for the existing message that you're on, it can absolutely grab the subject line. So yes, if you could take the have an Apple Script that took the subject line from the message and stuffed it in a temporary variable.
Variable, sure, yeah.
And then...
And the attachment.
Save the attachment. And then it could even stop there. And you could have the Apple Script do it all, but you could put that on the clipboard and let the Hazel thing I talked about sort of take over from there, maybe.
Yeah.
But probably Apple Script could do the whole thing. Yeah.
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 But what you might not be able to do is, if you're using the web interface for Gmail, you might actually have to like add the Gmail account to your Apple Mail and be parsing your mails from the actual application, not just, you know, the web interface or whatever. And I know a lot of people with Gmail just use the web interface.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Save it with...
Because I would doubt AppleScript's going to let you go into Gmail web interface and do any of that stuff.
Yep.
But I'm just surprised. Again, I'm
thinking
surprised
about
shortcuts.
It.
Mail wouldn't be able to parse parts of an email.
It can. Oh, AppleScript in mail can definitely.
Just like, I just mean, like, why there's not default shortcuts like copy subject, copy email body.
Right.
Copy, you know, email address from this email, like the
so I
from line.
I will put a link to this in the show notes, but I came up with a ChatGPT prompt to write this Apple Script. I need to say I have not tested this Apple Script. When you go and test it, folks, you may find that there are bugs in it. And then I encourage you to use ChatGPT to follow up with that and fix the bugs. But the prompt that I used was write an Apple Script to take the first attachment of the selected message in Apple Mail and save it with the file name being the current date and the subject line of the email. Just in case there's, you know, people says, you know, picture of Timmy, you want to have something, and maybe it should be a current date and time stamp so that if there's six pictures of Timmy, they all kind of get saved with that.
Right.
But looking briefly, because I happen to be recording a podcast at the moment, looking briefly at the Apple Script, it is able to grab the subject of the message, as part of a thing, and the attachment of the message. And we could probably make this far more robust and say, save all of the attachments, use an incremental number at the end of it, you know, so that there's multiples. Like, you could certainly do all that. But I will, this is doable with AppleScript, and the bones of what need to happen are here. I will put this link in the show notes to this ChatGPT session for you folks to experiment with.
Yep, yep. Cool.
Yep.
All right.
Fun.
So Ian.
Yep.
Needs help with a failing macOS upgrade. This is not something I've encountered in a while, so let's dig into this. He says, "Hi guys, I'm trying to get my neighbor's 2015 3.2 gigahertz Intel Core i5 with 16 gigs of memory and 1 terabyte Fusion drive upgraded to macOS 10.14, or from rather macOS 10.14 Mojave to, this seems backwards, macOS 12 Monterey. That's a downgrade. I'm confused by that, but okay. I ran the Monterey.
Maybe the other way around. Maybe he's going
to Mojave from Monterey.
Let's go with that.
Yes. Because he then says, well, no, I ran the Monterey installer from a Mojave installer. I'm questioning.
I am too.
Which versions are which point.
He
versions,
used the term upgraded. So I think we're going from 12 to 14. Let's assume
let's just use the numbers. So
that's right.
I ran the macOS 10.14 installer from a USB memory stick that has only the installer. Things were going well, and the iMac went through the usual operating system install routine with progress bars and restarts. After more than an hour spent on one of these progress bars, it restarted into recovery mode with a message that I'd never seen before. Your computer started up in recovery because a failure occurred during installation. An error occurred migrating the user data during install. Reinstall macOS to resolve the issue. I was trying to install the operating system again, but as it directs, but I have no faith it will do any better the second time. What went wrong with the install? Do you think that I should start fresh by wiping the internal Fusion drive clear, install macOS 10.14 on a clean drive, and then restore from Time Machine backup? Or is there some way to find out more about what went wrong with the migrating user data during the install? Ian.
Okay. I would follow Apple's instruction and try one more time again, right? Like, yep. Let's see if it works. Because who knows what happened, to your point, right? We don't know.
I have a guess.
Yeah, right. I want to get to your guess because this is interesting. But I would try it again. Barring that, though, yes, install on a fresh drive and then let migration, like get the OS on there and then let Migration Assistant do the second step. I know that's all what's happening behind the scenes here, but at least you're not stuck with a failed install. You're just, at worst, stuck with a failed migration that you can deal with in a different way. But what's your theory, yeah, Adam?
Well, I would boot that installer and then run Disk Utility, because my suspicion on a 2015 iMac with a Fusion drive is that the drive is probably borked. Like, it's probably got issues with it. That's a really old machine. I mean, that machine's been running for 9 years on that drive. So, and it's a spinning drive, and things happen over time. So even if it was running fine prior to doing the install, when you're doing an install, it's doing a lot of work and it's moving a lot of bits around, and it probably has bad sectors, or there's probably issues. So when it got to migrating the user data, it just literally probably couldn't copy the stuff. Yeah. So I hate to say that, but that would be my first suspicion on a machine of that era. You know, drives go bad. They just do eventually.
Yeah.
They get worn out.
Yeah.
So you could try again and you might luck out, you know, like Dave said, but I would definitely run Disk Utility on it, because maybe Disk Utility can actually fix what might be wrong with it. Like, there's probably some corruption or something in there. And, you know, I would try that if you hadn't run it. I mean, definitely it's worth running, especially on an older machine when you're doing a migration like that.
Yeah. Excellent point. Yeah, no, I think you're now that you've said it, that seems like the most likely issue here. So yeah, all right. I like it.
Luckily, I need to go back and look at the teardown for a 2015 iMac, but I mean, you probably could replace the drive in there. And even if you replace it with a real SSD, you could give that iMac brand new life.
Oh, for sure.
It might be worth doing with the cost of SSDs. I mean, yeah. It's probably got a smaller drive, I'm guessing. Like, you could probably get a 256 SSD and throw it in there and it would just be like, boom.
Yeah.
Might even be worth just doing that upgrade.
That's interesting. Yeah.
If that person really wants to keep that computer and doesn't want to spend, you know, money on a new
Mac. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah. Huh.
But I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I like it. All right. Cool. Shall
we
do?
Got one more for you, I think.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
We are going to, I lost my place in my notes.
It's Michael.
Who's next?
Michael's okay. Who I have in my notes next. So.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, so Michael has a Wi-Fi router question. This one's pretty straightforward. He just says, what Wi-Fi 7 router do you recommend? I've looked at the Netgear Nighthawk, and they have some for $299 all the way up to $699. Of course, the $699 is the one I want. It has the most features and the top speed.
Yeah. Okay. So I need to test more Wi-Fi 7 routers. And I say that, and that's true, but I could also say I need to test more Wi-Fi 7 routers like I need a hole in my head. But for the sake of the show, I do.
Yeah.
But thus far, the only ones that I've really put a test to are the Eero Max 7, which is $599 for each unit. And of course there's sales that can happen and all those things. And sometimes the sales are significant of like 20 or maybe 30%. But so the Eero Max 7, and I've also tested Unify's U7 Pro Max. Those are $279 each. Okay. The Unify ones are access points only. So you also need a router, but you can buy the Unify Cloud Gateway Max for $199 and the price still is way less than the Eero. I've had good connectivity with both of those. The Eero is a 10 stream device, so it's 2x4x4, whereas the U7 Pro Max is an 8 stream device, 2x4x2. With my iPhone 16, testing locally on my network with iPerf, so not doing speed tests so that my internet speeds aren't the limiting factor. And in this case, my internet speeds would definitely be the limiting factor, sort of. I am routinely able to get Wi-Fi speeds of 1500 megabits per second in both directions. It like Wi-Fi 7 actually delivers on the promise of gigabit plus speeds over Wi-Fi, and it really does work, and it happens routinely. I have two Eeros in my house, one sort of at either end of the house on different floors, and if I'm smack dab in the middle of them, I'm probably getting 700 to 800 megabits per second. But if I'm in the room with the device, it's and I also have one Eero Max 7 in my office. Usually right now it's a Unify U7 Pro Max because I wanted to do some testing. But with the Eero, I'm able to get 1500 with the Unify, sometimes 1500, more likely 11 or 1200. And that checks out with the different streams, I guess, because my iPhone 16 and the 16 Pro is the same, has four spatial streams, 2x2. So but maybe, you know, it finds the right ones in the stream, in the thing that are negotiates the best unencumbered ones and sends data and all of that. I did say, and I said the U7 Pro Max is the one. They also, Unify also has the U7 Pro, which I believe is 6 streams. Yeah. So Wi-Fi 7 works. It really, really does what we were promised for it to do. I do need to test some others because, as you can see, there's a massive price difference between the two that I've tested. I've moved from my Synology router, as I mentioned recently, over to the Unify Cloud Gateway Max. I love that thing. I have I moved to it primarily because the Synology only has one port that's faster than gigabit. And I don't understand why you would do that, because you want to get data in and out of it, right? It's just a router. So you would want a gigabit, a faster than gigabit port to your internet provider, and then also a faster than gigabit port to the rest of your network, because otherwise it don't matter. So that's the part. And with Synology, you can use it for one or the other. Like the port is, it could be WAN to the, up to the internet, or LAN down to your network. But once I put the Cloud Gateway Max in, it has all the same geeky features that I liked with the Synology. It has an equally flexible interface that is probably confusing for a first-time user, but once you learn your way around, of course, it's fine. You have to adapt to it. It doesn't adapt to you, but these are routers that there's a, you know, time-honored tradition of them being confusing. So it's just how it be. But it's fine once you spend a day with it. You're like, oh, yeah, I know where to go. And you can search and all that stuff. But
cool.
With that, it has two 2.5 gig ports on it. My connection from Fidium, Adam, is a 1 gig symmetrical.
Yep.
1 gigabit Ethernet maxes out at 940 megabits per second after all the overhead. Once I moved to, right, so that's important for what I'm about to share, because once I moved my gigabit connection to the 2.5 gig Ethernet ports and could actually send data over those speeds, because like my Mac Studio here has a 10 gig Ethernet port, but that's enough. I had to move all my switches in the house and the office over to 2.5 gig switches, which I, of course I did because I'm a nerd. Even on my Fidium 1 gig connection, I get 1150 megabits per second in both directions on a speed test up to the cloud. So it is over provisioned. It's faster than one gigabit. Yeah. Which makes sense. I mean, that's pretty typical. So,
cool.
So I share all of this because these are the important factors when buying a router that's going to do Wi-Fi 7 in today's world with gigabit or faster connections to the internet. It's not just about the speed of the router or the speed of the Wi-Fi. You need no encumbrances on your connection in the whole thing. And like in my office, the encumbrance is the Mac Mini that's there only has a gigabit Ethernet port. I didn't buy it with a 10 gig port. So I can't get faster than gigabit on that unless I add a Thunderbolt device or a USB 4 device that goes 2.5 gig Ethernet. I think I have one somewhere in the pile of things that looks like I'm a hoarder in my office, and I eventually will find it and plug it in. But
I want to know what people are doing with all this bandwidth. Honestly, this comes up. I mean, where this comes up a lot is when my wife and I are talking about like different places we want to live and where we might want to go. And especially when you're talking about like more remote areas, right?
Yep.
And for me, it was always about the upload speed more than the download speed. But that was because I was a podcaster and I was creating these giant audio files that I want to get up to the internet fast. Like I never had a problem with stuff coming down.
Sure.
It was always plenty fast. And like, even now with my, you know, I have gigabit and it's great. You know, if I really am being honest about it, especially now since the kids have moved out and we're not, you know, all streaming 4K video from different devices to different places all at the same time, like the amount of downstream bandwidth that we're probably using between my wife and I, even with the number of devices we have, I doubt it's really even saturating much of that gigabit, if I'm being truly honest with myself.
Oh, yeah. That is correct. And that's the reason that I have no desire to move to 2 gigabit fiber, which I could have, right? Like
I can too, yeah.
Yeah, and even the 1 gigabit fiber, the only reason I've gone with that is because I think it was $5 a month more than the 500 megabit per second fiber or something. Like it was very clear which one they wanted me to buy. They were going to, I don't think they would provision the line for 1 gig, but they were going to carve out 1 gig per customer in their world. And by golly, we might as well just have them buy it, you know, like, you know,
yeah.
So That's why I did it. Now, when my 1 year comes up with Fidium, which will mean that the I'm not locked into a contract with them, but they have committed to, you know, my price of $69 a month for 1 year. After that year, it's going to go up to 90. But I could change plans to either a faster speed or a slower speed and pay less than 90. I think I would pay $10 more than I am now. So it would be 80 for the 2 gig connection, or, you know, whatever it is, 50 for the 500. So I will move to one of those. I think we all know which one I'm going to move to. Obviously, I'm going to move to the 2 gig connection. Like, let's just get that out of the way. But I really don't need it. And after a year, I will move back to the 1 gig connection. Like,
my gigabit is way expensive, but I'm in a remote rural area, or not really remote, but I mean, it just is what it is. I pay way more than I should be paying, but it's, market number of people actually buying it to probably what it costs, you know?
Yes.
So like, there's not a huge number of people to sell to here that are going to pay for it. So it gets divvied up a little bit less than in other areas where they can spread out the cost.
Yep.
So,
exactly. Yeah. So, but you know, I use my upstream for cloud backups, for sure. And then it's also really nice to have, you know, faster than 40 megabit per second upstream, which is what I was limited to with Comcast, when uploading the show files. Like, it's nice not to just have to wait forever for that to happen. Although very few destinations on the internet let me upload at full gigabit speed, let alone faster than that. When uploading the video of the show to Spotify, that goes at about 400 to 500 megabits per second is the fastest they'll accept that from me. Their servers throttle there. Apple servers, when I upload the audio to them for the premium stuff or whatever the heck Apple calls it. I hate that we have to bifurcate premium with that. Like, it really chafes me. There's part of me that wishes we had not open that particular thing with Apple subscriptions, but I digress. uploading that to them goes at gigabit speed. So yeah. Apple servers accept it. But that, you know, that it, where it's nice is I can tell people, listen, just watch whatever you want on my Plex server. Watch your 4K content. I don't care. Right. I have so much headroom here. It's ridiculous. So please use it. You know, that kind of thing is part of it. And then I can tell people, and set your Plex client not to ask my server to do transcoding, right? Like, take the full bandwidth. It's better for both of us. So,
cool. So,
Shall we do a couple of cool stuff found before we call it a day here, Adam?
I think so. Yeah.
All right.
Raymond's got one here. Great.
But I promise I will test more Wi-Fi 7 stuff. Like, we need to find, I am now on a quest to find the affordable Wi-Fi 7 solution that will serve a gigabit Ethernet connection and give you some headroom for something faster. Like, we're going to find it. Right now, that solution is, and affordable is tough. Like, I really like the Eero. Obviously, it's super easy to use, but man, like, it's expensive. But everything there is expensive. The Unify is so far the least expensive way I've found to do it. And it just shocks me to say those words about Unify. They were always, I mean, they're prosumer stuff. They're also enterprise. In my brain, I always expect them to be the most expensive, and they're really affordable stuff and quality stuff. So,
yes. Yeah. Good.
Yep.
Yep. So Raymond has something that's a little bit of a follow-up to a conversation we were having on previous podcasts. I don't remember if it was the last podcast or not, but he says, in listening to your last podcast about lifespan to track your SSD life, I wanted to tell you about an app that I bought a long time ago called Drive DX to track the life of my SSDs, which you can download for free to try, and it only costs $19.99 for one user and $39.99 for a family. If you didn't know about this app, you should take a look. I didn't know about that app, but yeah, we had been talking about SSD and the SSDs and the fact that they have a, you know, expected lifespan, and this will allow you, I guess, to kind of monitor that, track it, and see where you're at.
Yep. We have mentioned DriveDX on this show many times over the years, but it's been a while. In fact, I think they still have most of our mentions listed under their Mac Observer tab. But yes, it's every one of them is Mac Geek App, Mac Geek App, Mac Geek App, Mac Geek App. So maybe we'll have them replace that logo with the MGG logo. So, you know, yeah, it's good. But yeah, that's a fun tool and a good geeky tool to remind ourselves of. So, yep. I have a cool stuff found to mention here, and it is I am someone who puts a case on my iPhone. I have generally gone for a clear, you know, plastic or whatever the material is case, and I have one of those. And then the folks at Mujo. You know, we get a lot of things to review here. The folks at Mujo, I think I'm pronouncing it right, M-U-J-J-O, sent me their full leather case for the iPhone 16. And I put it on to test it for a day. And I haven't been able to bring myself to take it off yet, Adam. It feels good. It is MagSafe. You can see, if you're watching the video for this, you can see, actually, I have my Geek Gab pop socket on there now. I have a Mac Geek Gab one around here, too. Actually, my Mac Geek Gab one is on my wallet. But it's all MagSafe. It works great on my, you know, MagSafe charger next to my bed, and it feels good in my hand. It comes in two colors. It is either dark tan or black, and it's $59. And I've had leather cases on my phones in the past, and they haven't lasted. Not that the leather hasn't lasted, but they haven't lasted for me. I just have never found one that I like the feel of. This one, like, I trust it in my hand to not fall, and it feels good, but it also doesn't get, like, grimy, which sometimes for me leather does. I have weird sensory things. So, I don't know. Yeah, but I this was meant to be on here for a day, and it's been on here for arrived 3 days after I got my phone. So, you know, yeah.
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 I used to use Apple's leather ones when Apple had real leather, and stopped when they stopped making those.
Sure.
So that's interesting to me. Although at this point I don't know that I can go back. I went all last year without a case on my iPhone. Really? My family thought I was crazy, and I've continued, and I'm probably going to continue. I love it. I love not having a case on my phone, and I feel like Apple's glass and the durability has gotten strong enough. Now, I am pretty good with my phone, knock on wood. I don't think I ever dropped my iPhone 14 Pro.
Yeah.
So
I was going to go caseless when I got the 15 Pro last year. I'm like, it's titanium. I'm good. I'll use MagSafe, you know, like whatever, a pop socket or something to give myself grip. And maybe the night that my phone came, like it wasn't 24 hours old. I had like lounge pants on or whatever. I had my phone in the pocket, and I went out to, like, I don't know why, but I needed something from the office or the studio. So it was like 10 o'clock at night. My phone's in my pocket. I'm running across the driveway. And because my pants are not like jeans, they're like lounge pants, the phone bounces out, hits it. And that iPhone to this day still has a nick in the corner because of its, and I'm like you, rarely drop my phone, but this was like, and I'm like, it's titanium. It's supposed to be, it was super soft titanium. It's like, it's not good.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I put a case back on, but I envision a world. I always put a tempered glass screen protector on my phones. Yeah. And
do that either.
Oh, that. Man, my family puts them on their phones too. That has saved our bacon many times. I dropped my iPhone, whatever it was at the time, face down on my friend's driveway. There's a theme here. As I was getting, I was going to his house for band practice. I was getting stuff out. I had, you know, 16 things to hold in two hands and my phone, and it fell perfectly flat face down on his like asphalt driveway. And I'm like, oh no. And I picked up my phone, and it was Spider Crack City. I'm like, well, here it comes. And then I peeled off that tempered glass screen protector, and Adam, it was totally fine. Totally fine. So I continue to put one of those on, and I put one on my phone last year too. There's the cheap ones that you can buy for like $9 for three of them. Those work great. I will say I have the Belkin one as well. It's way more expensive than $9 per three, and it feels, you know, we mentioned in the show earlier, cheap and worth it. The $9 for three, cheap and worth it. But they work. They will protect your phone. They just don't feel as good as the ones you pay a little bit more money for from someone like Belkin. So,
yeah. Nope, Dave, I'm naked and not afraid.
Well, I'm hesitant to use that as our title for the show, but I feel like we kind of have to. I don't know what ChatGPT is going to come up with for a picture on this, but I'm like watching a train wreck, Adam. I am eager to see. I won't be able to shield my eyes from it. So if we can make that work, it's probably going to be the thing. Oh, man. Why did you do that? Pete wasn't even here. Like, we could have avoided the whole thing.
Because, I mean, that's really what I've become. I always used to have a case and worry about these things, and now I've gone over a year, almost 2 years, not worrying about it, and it's free.
Yeah.
Let's just say that.
No, I believe it. I thought I was heading down this path, and then I was steered away immediately. So, yeah. Yeah. You're making me think, though, maybe I should try this again.
Well, I don't know. I mean, again, the only reason I left was because Apple decided they didn't want to do real leather cases. And I loved having a real leather case.
Yeah,
and Apple's
for sure.
One was actually pretty good.
Yep.
They kind of got cheaper towards the end, which was a little bit frustrating.
Interesting.
My early ones seemed to last a lot longer. A lot of it was the cutouts and stuff like that. Oh, I remember real quick before we get out of here. On that one, how are they handling the camera button?
Right. So, this is a great, great question. So all of the cases that I have tested thus far just have a cutout for the camera button.
Cutout, yeah.
It's a giant cutout. I don't have a problem using it. I mean, you do have to like aim your finger kind of right to get down into there and hit the thing. But I don't have a problem using it. Lisa she never uses her camera button because she says it's a pain in the neck. And I said, all right. So she will be our test case. I'm going to find her a case that has like what Apple's doing with the camera button, where they've effectively raised it up, you know, so that you can get all the functionality without it being deep down in there. For me, it's not a problem, but I totally understand that problem. Yeah, for sure.
It might actually be a benefit for some people. I've accidentally pressed it a few times, just like holding my phone in certain positions, which is really annoying. The other one that I wish, and I get why it can't do this, but I don't know why I keep thinking I'll activate it and then be like, okay, I want to get out of the camera, and I want to press it again to get out of the camera, but obviously that takes a photo.
That takes a picture.
I've done it like twice.
Oh, yeah. I definitely found, like, we went out to dinner the other night for our anniversary, and I took a picture from the table and then put my phone away, but I had my phone with me, like, at the end of the meal in the bathroom or whatever, and as I was looking the next day, it was like, well, where's that picture I took of the table before we were at the chef's table and I got this cool picture.
Right. Yeah. I saw that.
Yeah. And I was looking and I'm like, wait, what's this picture? I'm like, oh, this was randomly taken in the bathroom, but it was of the bathroom ceiling. I'm like, oh, I know exactly how that happened. You know, I like grabbed my phone off the like sink or whatever after I've washed up and it took a picture straight up and down of the ceiling. I'm like,
thank goodness.
Well, could have been worse.
That angle.
Not hot dog. That's right. Not hot dog. That's right. That was one of my favorite episodes or favorite storylines of Silicon Valley. So anyway, all right. Naked and not afraid, not hot dog. Thanks for hanging out with us, folks. This has been all too much fun. Don't forget about our monthly giveaways. They will persist. I am driven to always have one for us. So it's going to happen. Thanks to Cashfly for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Make sure to go check out Pete's other show. So there I was. I've got two other shows, Business Brain and Gig Gab. I got Buck Dharma from Bloister Cult coming up on Gig Gab. He was a fun conversation. Really
awesome,
pleasant guy.
Dude.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool to talk to somebody like that who's been through that. Anyway, thanks for hanging out. Thanks to all our premium supporters. Thanks for listening. Thanks for just being you. It's awesome. Adam, what's the, what do you
yes,
want to say? Yeah. Anything?
My little bit of advice to all of you is go out there and don't get caught.
Thank you again, everybody. Have a good week. See you next time. Later.